Support from Community Blood Services of Illinois, the nonprofit agency providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. Donation information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org. Blood donation. It's about life.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Our producers, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, Jason Croft is at the controls. Tomorrow morning, we'll be talking with Philip Graham and Tanya Leatsakos. They've been here regularly over the past few years, occasionally, and we talk about what's new in the book world. Philip is a writer. He teaches writing at the University of Illinois. Tanya works at the Pages for All Ages bookstore, and they are voracious readers. And when they stop by, they bring big armloads of new books to talk about and recommend. And, of course, you can do the same. In the second hour of the program tomorrow, we will talk with Barry Strauss. He's a military historian from Cornell. And we'll be talking about one of the great naval battles of history. And this was a battle that took place in the year 480 B.C., between Greece and Persia, the Battle of Salamis. And we'll talk about that and a little bit about maritime warfare in the ancient world in the second part of the program tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. Probably before September 11th of 2001, few Americans gave much thought to the question of interrogation of suspects of terrorism. But certainly people after that have thought about it, and particularly, if not then, since this past spring when the Abu Ghraib prison scandal broke. Just where do you draw that line between appropriate methods of interrogation and something that would have to be classified as torture? How far do we go in pursuit of information about terrorism? That's a question we'll try to consider in this part of Focus 580. As we talk with Greg Miller, he's a national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times in the paper's Washington, D.C. bureau. And he was the only American reporter who had access to American interrogators and document exploitation teams working in Afghanistan, interrogating people who were suspected of being involved in al-Qaeda. And he's authored a book, co-authored, in fact, with another man identified in the book as Chris Mackey, who was one of the Army's senior interrogators. And the book is out recently. It's titled The Interrogators: Inside the Secret War Against Al-Qaeda, and it's published by Little Brown. It's out now in the bookstore if you want to take a look at it. Of course, questions are welcome. We just ask people to be brief so we can keep the program moving, get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have the toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. Mr. Miller, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
Hey,
I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So how is it that you managed to have this kind of access to the people who were doing this work?
Well, it was partly by design and partly by accident, as typical in these sort of situations. I had spent a couple months just arranging for a trip to Afghanistan with the Army to get some access to their document exploitation teams. I was just very curious about how these people go about doing what they do. These are the guys who get big documents dumped on desks in their tents after special forces raids and things like that, and they sift through them, the materials, looking for information. And while I was there, I just kept meeting additional people and sort of maybe talked my way into getting to talk to some of the interrogators who were working at the prison at Bagram.
Well, I'm really struck by, you know, some of the introductory comments that this fellow that you got a chance to know, and a lot of it is about his stories of his experiences,
yeah.
This Chris Mackey, who talks about the fact that people who were assigned to do this kind of work were trained to do it in a certain context, that is the context of the Cold War, and I guess we're trained to do interrogation of Soviet soldiers, or people like that, and that the kind of training that they had didn't translate very well to this new situation with a new kind of person that they're trying to get information out of. Obviously, one issue here is language. But that may be a less of an issue than tailoring your approach to a very different kind of situation, because a Soviet line soldier and right. somebody who was involved in Al-Qaeda, for a variety of reasons, these are very different kind of people, and the same approach apparently won't work. What exactly is the difference, as far as you understand it, between doing those interrogations of those two different kind of individuals?
Well, there are numerous points in which they're different. I mean, at a very basic level, as you say, these interrogators who were working with Chris, and we interviewed many of them for the book, these were among the first interrogators to arrive in Afghanistan after the September 11 attacks. And they had been trained largely in Cold War methodology, in anticipating a conflict of conventional armies, situations where you would have prisoner of war camps with, you know, thousands of troops perhaps, all wearing uniforms, all wearing rank insignia, all easily sort of identified by their jobs in whatever their unit was, and you were just sort of expected to question these people directly. And much of the emphasis in the training for Army interrogators in this regard was just knowing where a Russian soldier fit into his unit so you could ask intelligent questions. Well, in Afghanistan, they were getting a completely different kind of prisoner. These were prisoners who were coming in not only without any uniforms, just wearing ordinary Afghan garb or Arab clothing. Often they didn't have any form of identification, or would claim to not to know their full name, their last name, would claim not to know their actual birth date. And so at a very basic level, I mean, all of the initial sort of analysis that you're trained to do as an Army interrogator was not going to work on these prisoners. And beyond that, I would say that, you know, another critical difference is that you would, these prisoners that the United States was taking into custody in Afghanistan, many of them were ideologically steeled. They were religious fanatics. They were motivated by a deep belief in their cause. Unlike a typical Soviet, East German, some sort of Eastern Bloc soldier, who might be patriotic and loyal to his country, but isn't going to see it as a cause with the same vigor as a member of Al Qaeda or the Taliban.
I suppose another difference would be is that, for example, if you're talking about American soldiers and Soviet soldiers, here we have two countries that are signatories to the Geneva Convention. So at least a Soviet soldier might be afraid of what might happen to him, but at least would think, well, if they follow the rules, I'm not going to be tortured. Well, apparently the people in Al-Qaeda were actually told to expect to be tortured.
Well, they were told... I think you're referring to a chapter in the book. This is one of the critical discoveries for the Americans during that part of the war. One day, a special forces team, I believe, brings back a pile of documents, and they pull it out on the table, and in that pile is an Al-Qaeda training manual that talks about which offers instruction on how to resist interrogation, not only from the United States interrogators, but from interrogators in other countries as well. And there's a very dark contrast there between what these Al-Qaeda members are taught to expect from American captors versus, say, an Egyptian interrogator. And in fact, the manual basically says you can expect not to be mistreated by the Americans. In fact, they're weak. They won't mistreat you. This is their vulnerability. And in fact, you should seek to provoke some sort of confrontation in the booth. See if you can draw your interrogator to commit some act of violence so that you can complain to the Red Cross and start some sort of outcry over your treatment. That's the best thing you can do. In that same manual, it goes into detail about the various methods of torture you might expect to encounter if you were taken into custody in an Arab nation or another nation that does engage in torture. And it basically advises you, and there are certain cases in which all you can do is pray to Allah.
The United States is signatory to the Geneva Convention. Also, there's an international convention against torture. So there are certain things that we have promised that we would not do that also in addition to violating those international agreements, would be violations of United States law.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, though, there seemed to be this understanding that there a certain level of, I don't know what you want to call it, coercion about aggression, something that was going to be necessary to get people to give you the information that you want. So I guess I'm thinking about all of the questions that have been raised about what goes on in Guantanamo, what's happened in Afghanistan, what's happened in Iraq. From your talking with the people that you talk to that are charged with doing this in kind of interrogation, were they told very clearly and explicitly what they could and could not do?
In a sense, David. I mean, the Geneva Conventions are lengthy legal documents that basically stipulate that, you know, you're not to be punish prisoners for refusing to cooperate. You're not to engage in humiliation of prisoners. There are a number of provisions. Despite all that language, there is a lot of wiggle room there. There's lots of room for interpretation, and we've seen it just in recent months how there were memos flying around the legal offices at the Pentagon, the Justice Department here in Washington, coming up with their own interpretations of these documents and what it meant to abide by them. I know that Chris and the other members of his unit and the interrogators that we write about in Afghanistan, when they got to Afghanistan, they were playing by very strict rules. They were not using things like sleep deprivation or stress positions as a means of getting information out of prisoners. But over time, as they became increasingly frustrated with their inability to get useful information from these prisoners, they start to embrace versions of these methods, and they start to really try to figure out how they can move in that direction without abandoning the Geneva Convention, still sort of convince themselves that they're in compliance with the conventions, and yet use harsher methods. And we write at length about this. I mean, this is one of the central themes of the book, is that in these prisons there's always this tension between getting the information that could save lives, not only those of your soldiers in the war on terrorism, but those of Americans and citizens of other countries, versus the adherence to the Geneva Conventions and doing what's right. And one of the ways they sort of rationalized this in Afghanistan is to come up with a rule where you can question a prisoner for hours on end, as long as you don't swap out interrogators on him. In other words, an interrogation can last as long as the interrogator can hold up. You can't tag team a prisoner and try to keep him up for days on end as a means of extracting information. That, therefore, these interrogators internally, they reach the decision, they would argue, you're not treating the prisoner any worse than you are your own soldier.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure that they feel, as you say, that in their pursuit of information, there is a lot at stake. Would you say that if you ask them about their methods, they would say, we went up to the line, but no further? Or would they say, well, you know, maybe occasionally we stepped over that line a little bit, but we felt that what we were doing was so important, the pursuit of this information was so vital, that we could justify to ourselves the fact that we had stepped over the line?
All of the interrogators that we write about in this book and who were part of this unit in Afghanistan would point to the former. They would all argued that they stepped up to that line but didn't cross it. They never touched prisoners, never engaged in physical coercion. But at the same time, I mean, this sort of, I could tag this on to your last question, David. I mean, if you read the Army Field Interrogation Manual, it spells out for you, you're not to engage in physical torture. You're not to punish prisoners physically or things like that. But psychological games are fair play. I mean, those are allowed. And so even though these Army interrogators were complying with the Geneva Conventions, they were still engaging in what some would call coercive behavior because they were playing using ruses that would, you know, designed to convince these prisoners that if they their future might be being transferred to a country like Egypt or something like that.
Well, let me ask you this one more question, then we have a caller we'll get to, and of course other people who are listening are welcome. I think particularly since the Abu Ghraib story broke, but perhaps even before that, people were raising this question of the use of coercion in interrogation and have suggested something like the value of the information that you get is inversely proportional to the degree of coercion in the interrogation. And that if you get into what anybody would call torture, you get to the point where the individual will tell you whatever it is they think you want to know. And that would cast that, you know, make you raise a big question about, well, are they telling you something that is true? Are they giving you genuine information? Or they just want you to stop whatever it is that you are doing? You know, so having said all that, if you look at the kind of information that we have gotten, for example, for the kind of information that the people that you have talked to have turned up about Al-Qaeda, the organization and its activities, can we really say that we have gotten very much in the way of valuable information?
Well, I think they've gotten a great deal of valuable information. There are certain critical pieces of information that they haven't gotten. I mean, nobody has been able to point the U.S. or other countries to the specific location of Osama bin Laden, for example. But as we document in this book, they gathered a great deal of very useful intelligence on all manner of subjects, ranging from the paths that Arabs were following as they tried to flee Afghanistan to safer ground, the organizations of so-called charities that were conduits for money to Al-Qaeda. They uncovered plots that did target civilians, including a plot involving the U.S. Embassy in Rome. And so there were lots of cases where they got very valuable information. I mean, you touched on a very fundamental question, sort of, does torture work? Mm-hmm. Does coercion work in getting information? If you talk to interrogators, as you say, many of them will tell you that it only leads to bad information because a prisoner will say anything to ease the pain. As we say in our book, I'm not sure that that's necessarily the case. For instance, right now we're told that the CIA, which is holding very senior Al-Qaeda figures at undisclosed locations, is using a method of interrogation called waterboarding, in which prisoners are strapped to a board and submerged to make them believe that they might be drowning. It's a means to get them to give up information. I mean, the agency went to a lot of trouble to get permission to use this method, getting special permissions from the Justice Department and so forth. They wouldn't go to that trouble to do that if they didn't consider that an effective method. The reasons for not going that far, however, are profound. I mean, the argument against torture is not that it's ineffective. It is that it undermines your cause in more fundamental ways. It's that it knocks you off the moral high ground, and it's that it breeds more enemies. I mean, if you the impact of Abu Ghraib, I think, is going to be felt for a generation. As many people have said, that is those pictures that we saw of the abuse of those prisoners will function as recruiting posters for Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations for years to come.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Greg Miller. He's a national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times in the paper's Washington, D.C. bureau, and was the only American reporter who got access to U.S. interrogators working in Afghanistan. And he has co-authored, along with a man named in the book as Chris Mackey, who is a senior interrogator in the military. They're authors together of the book The Interrogators, Inside the Secret War Against Al-Qaeda, and it's published by Little Brown. We do have a couple of callers here. Let's talk with them, starting with someone who is listening this morning in Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Actually, the question I was going to ask is the one that David just asked you, in which you sort of answered about what sort of information you get after you try to kill somebody to tell you something. So I'll ask a less important question, perhaps. How much information can you get from somebody that's been away from the battlefield for 2 years?
That's a very good question. And I think the answer is that obviously their current intelligence grows stale very quickly. I mean, it's not very long after a prisoner is captured that his knowledge of current plots that are set in motion, the whereabouts of his colleagues, expires. It becomes not useful. what the Pentagon has argued about the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, and I think that's what the caller is probably referring to, because a number of those prisoners have now been in custody for years, and we're often asking, what value can they be now? The Pentagon argues that certain prisoners at Guantanamo Bay were senior enough in al-Qaeda or the Taliban that even now, when we get new intelligence on say, a cell uncover new information about a cell somewhere in the world, a terrorist cell, that those prisoners in Guantanamo might know the identities of those people, might know the backgrounds of those people, might be able to confirm when they came through Afghanistan, when they came to the al-Qaeda training camps. And so they can help sort of flesh out scraps of more current information by providing background.
All right, let's go to the next caller, and I believe that they are in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
I would like to ask you a question. With the United States going into Iraq, did that help the people that had those prisoners in Cuba to get information? Didn't that sort of harden them? And another thing I want to ask you, do you have any information about the prisoner abuse in Iraq? And also, I would like to know where and what countries did those people, interrogators, come from that questions these people, and I was wondering why was they treating the Iraqis just like they was the one involved in 9/11. I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, you and I know that you have done some reporting for your paper, the LA Times, about the whole Abu Ghraib situation. Let's talk about that.
Well, I mean, the caller was asking whether the invasion of Iraq has hardened the opinions of any of the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. It's impossible to know. It's impossible to even know whether they are aware that the United States invaded Iraq. I mean, they live in very controlled circumstances, and I'm not sure how that would play in. I mean, the war in Iraq certainly stretched the resources of the ranks of the U.S. interrogators. As we say in the beginning of the book, one of the fundamental lessons of September 11 was that the United States had become far too dependent on sophisticated, expensive, technical means of intelligence collection, satellites, signals intercepts, that kind of thing, and had let its human intelligence gathering capabilities really atrophy. So when the war in Afghanistan started, there were only a little more than 100 interrogators who spoke Arabic. And that's just for a country that was about to go to war in Afghanistan, and also for a country with a war in Iraq on the horizon, that's a mind-boggling number. It's just such a low number.
The caller was asking a question about the people who were doing the interrogation, and I'm not sure whether she was talking about Afghanistan or Guantanamo Bay or Iraq, but maybe in all three of those cases, are these people all Americans, or are there other people who are involved in the interrogations that are not Americans?
Well, at the prison at Bagram, I mean, the U.S. Army interrogators, they are all U.S. citizens. Some of them were not born in the United States. There are a couple who spoke Arabic as their native language, but most learned Arabic or another language after enlisting in the Army and going off for a year of language training at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California. But there were members of others who were also at the prison and who are also working at other prisons that the U.S. runs in Iraq and elsewhere. I mean, there were interrogators and intelligence professionals from Britain, Germany and Australia and other countries who were also coming in and out of this facility questioning prisoners. The facility was run by the United States. It was a United States Army-run prison, but in a war like Afghanistan, where you have a number of international partners, you're working alongside interrogators from other countries in many cases.
Hmm. thinking about Abu Ghraib and what has happened there, or at least our pursuit of trying to find out what happened there, the military on their side seems to continue to say that what happened there was the result of a small number of people who were out of control, your bad actor, your bad apples sort of theory, and that it didn't go that far up the chain of command. Other people have said they find a hard time believing that, that it could simply be those people. Some of them who have spoken about what happened there have said they felt that they were just doing what they were told to do. And there have been some journalists, and I guess primarily I'm thinking of Seymour Hersh and the stuff that he wrote for The New Yorker, who suggested that what happened at Abu Ghraib can be traced back to essentially to Afghanistan, because he makes this argument that, you know, in Afghanistan, we discovered that we had to use some level of coercion to get usable information. It worked there. So we took that kind of technique, those techniques, and we exported them from Afghanistan to Iraq. And there again, that raises the issue of where up the chain of command the decision to do that came from, and right. raises the, and again, calls into question this idea, well, that these people who were doing it just woke up one day and decided they were going to start to abuse the prisoners.
Right.
So having said all that, and again, I know you're having done some reporting on this, what do you think about that? How do you sort all that out and try and determine who is responsible?
Well, I think there's two pieces that we're looking at here, actually. I think you can look at the and see clearly an escalation in approved interrogation methods. When you look at the list of approved interrogation methods in place at Abu Ghraib, there were methods that were far more aggressive than the interrogators in Afghanistan were allowed to employ, including the use of dogs to intimidate prisoners, putting hoods on them for extended periods as a form of sensory deprivation. And so that's clearly coming from leadership at the prison, at least at the prison, and probably higher. Now, the other piece of it is what we've all seen in these horrible photos of prisoners being stripped naked and stacked up in pyramids and placed on boxes and those sorts of things. I mean, 7 military police soldiers have been charged in that case, and most of them have said that they felt they were encouraged to do this or directed to do this by military intelligence soldiers, who, for their part, would deny any such thing. But we haven't solved that part of it. I mean, that's still the fundamental question hovering over this scandal. We don't know, for instance, very much about the extent to which all of these memos that were circulating at high levels in Washington about interrogation methods, to what extent any of that trickled down to that facility at Abu Ghraib. I will say this as well. I mean, if you read our book, you'll get a real feel for the tension that exists in a prison, as we talked about earlier in the program, between doing the right thing and trying to get information, and how easy it is to sort of slip. And this is at a facility where, at most, you have a couple hundred prisoners in custody at any point in time. Abu Ghraib was magnitudes larger, 6,000, 7,000 prisoners in custody at any point in time, a sprawling compound. I mean, if you were a sadistic person and wanted to get away with it, torturing prisoners, it would be easier to do it at a place like Abu Ghraib than it would be at a place like Bagram.
Another one of these questions, at least it seems difficult for me, and I think it also seemed difficult for some of the people who in the Congress and others who are, again, trying to figure out what happened at Abu Ghraib, was that we do seem to have two different groups working in the prison. We have people who essentially were sent there to be guards, to be the equivalent of the guards that we have in correctional institutions here in the United States, and then other people who were involved in trying to collect intelligence.
Right.
And the question is, and on the one side, we had these people who were guards, and there was a general who was in charge of this prison. But even she seemed to say that she didn't really feel that she was in charge or wasn't sure who was in charge, and that perhaps instead of essentially the military corrections people being in charge, it was the military intelligence people who were in charge. which seem to be just slightly more shadowy and more difficult to determine who again, where that chain of command goes.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously there was a great deal of confusion about the chain of command at Abu Ghraib. The Taguba report cited that as one of the main breakdowns in leadership at that prison. And one of the main contributing factors was just a confusing chain of command where it wasn't clear whether the MIs were running the place, as we often call military intelligence soldiers, or MPs, the military police. Now, I mean, the fact is that at a prison, if it's going to function correctly and it's going to produce useful intelligence in the war on terrorism, they're going to have to work together to some degree. You can't have sort of a real hard walls dividing these two different groups of soldiers, because the military intelligence troops do rely on MPs to a large extent, not only for sequestering prisoners, isolating prisoners who they want to be kept away from the rest of the detainees in the cages or something like that, and moving them back and forth from the cages up to the booths where the interrogations take place. But military intelligence troops, if they're doing their job, are also constantly quizzing the MPs about the prisoners' behavior in the booths or in the cells, trying to learn something about them. I mean, if you get a new group of prisoners in, the MPs will often be asked to pay careful attention to see, well, who seems most frightened, because that might be a candidate for a quick interrogation. A prisoner might be easy to break. Who is the one that the other prisoners are sort of turning to for leadership and sort of deferring to, because that might be the most important prisoner in that group. So there has to be a relationship there. And this is another issue that we really haven't completely resolved in the context of Abu Ghraib, is how significant a factor was it that there was so much confusion over who was in charge of that place.
In Afghanistan, was that confusion present?
I think it was less so, partly because, as I said a minute ago, it was just a smaller facility. Mm-hmm. I think the provost marshal, which is not a military intelligence job, runs the prison. But there were small units of interrogators and a fairly small number of MPs, and they met with each other two or three times a day. They knew each other because they worked at such close quarters, so they were all sort of part of the same team. It was not quite like Abu Ghraib, where you had this sprawling place, and you had one group of MPs who would come in for the night shift who the interrogators might never even work with or deal with.
We have some callers here. Let's talk with them. Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Hi. I'm really having problems with your logic about water torches effective, and that's why they struggle to get it approved. I think that sadism is simply addictive, and people who are torturing someone get addicted to that power, and I think Abu Ghraib is the perfect example of that, because according to a Newsweek article, at least half of those identified in those photographs were petty criminals. They were in no way going to give us any type of military intelligence. My other question is about the value of the information, or the reason why they were having such difficulty getting information in Afghanistan. In the alternative media, they've said that because the United States Army was paying for these prisoners, quite often they got people that the warlords couldn't sell to someone else, and perhaps some really top value, quote-unquote, people got out. But a lot of the prisoners that the United States finally got were people who simply were caught in the crossfire, people who couldn't be ransomed by their families or really had no information, and the other party simply wanted the reward. And another problem that's really coming to mind, I'm not sure how this is going to work, is that in Afghanistan, people speak Farsi and they speak Pashtun and a lot of other tribal languages, and I would suspect under torture, Arabic as a second language would just not work, because I think someone under torture is under such stress, I don't think they're relating in their second language at all. So I think just from your discussion, there's a lot of reasons why they couldn't get information, and I don't know if it was the quality of the torture or is it the quantity of the torture. It might have simply been the quality of the interrogation.
Well, the callers raised a number of good points there. There was a significant problem with innocent prisoners of no intelligence value being brought into the prison because there was a reward system that prompted warlords were collecting large amounts of money just by the head almost, or turning over prisoners. And the army took a long time to figure out how to sort these people, and it still hasn't quite figured it out. I mean, we're continuing to see small batches of prisoners released from Guantanamo Bay here and there. And it's increasingly clear that there were people who were held there who didn't need to be held there. On the caller's first point about the addictive nature of torture, that's also valid. And that's an argument that's something that interrogators who go through the interrogation course at Fort Huachuca, Arizona, for the Army and elsewhere, I mean, this is a point that is repeatedly made to them by their instructors, that there are many arguments against torture and coercion, and I ticked off a few minutes ago, but another one is that you become dependent on that as a method. If you don't, if you engage in it, then you lose the skills that you learn that enable you to get information out of prisoners through non-coercive means. And in our book, documents cases where prisoners broke mainly because they realized that they were not going to be mistreated in American custody, and it gave them pause about what side they were on. It snapped their wiring in a way. It caused them to reconsider their allegiance to their cause, because they expected to be mistreated. When they learned that they weren't, it realigned their views.
I hope the caller will forgive me for wanting to go on here, because the lines are full and we're moving into our last 15 minutes. Our guest, Greg Miller, is national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and the paper's Washington, D.C. Bureau. He's the co-author of the book, The Interrogators, Inside the Secret War Against Al-Qaeda, and the publisher of the book is Little Brown. Next, we'll go to a caller in Champaign County, and it's line one.
Hi, I'm also somewhat skeptical. It seems to me that you're looking at one portion of the whole interrogation system, and we had the example of last week, Thursday, when the new latest Army investigator said it wasn't systematic, et cetera, and didn't know about unmuzzled dogs being loud, and didn't acknowledge that there were anything such as ghost prisoners, which I think your colleague William Arkin at the L.A. Times was pretty instrumental in getting that leak. So you're just looking at what the old thing about the elephant. You're looking at the trunk. I think there's another portion of the animal that needs examination, and I think that the high-value, quote-unquote, prisoners probably don't see even Guantanamo. They are somewhere else, and we have nobody reporting back about what's going on there.
That's right. I mean, the caller is right that there are other high-value prisoners that we don't know. We simply don't know even where they're being held. They're in CIA custody at, as they put it, an undisclosed location. There's lots of speculation about where that might be, and some people think that Diego Garcia, this island in the Indian Ocean, would be a logical place. But clearly no reporters are allowed there. Not even the Red Cross is allowed to see these facilities where these senior al-Qaeda prisoners are being detained. We're talking about prisoners like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And so there are real questions about what is happening there. The caller's other point about the evidence of there being a systematic problems, I would agree with him, and I think that the report that came out earlier this week or late last week was widely sort of viewed as completely inadequate. The New York Times editorial the following day dubbed it a whitewash on Abu Ghraib, and I know many people who agree with that assessment. I think it's clear that there are problems throughout the system, not just at Abu Ghraib, because there were two prisoners who died in Afghanistan at Bagram prison in December of 2002. We've yet to hear an explanation as to why or how that happened. The interrogation unit that I write about in this book had left Bagram in August of that year, so they're unable to provide answers to what happened several months later. We've had cases of prisoners in CIA custody who've died under extreme interrogation methods. We have a a CIA contract employee who's now charged with that crime. So, I mean, there are, the question is whether this is in some ways reflects the top-down leadership from the higher-ups of the Pentagon or even the Bush administration. And although you can debate that, but it's clear that the signals from the administration consistently were that, you know, these are prisoners who aren't entitled to the Geneva Conventions, aren't entitled to prisoner of war status, and that does send a message. It's undeniable.
Well, those are two huge caveats. One, that you're looking at only one, you know, the army in Afghanistan. There are probably other safe houses in Afghanistan itself. And the other thing about Abu Ghraib is that it wasn't simple intimidation. It was a calculated humiliation with the intent, in some cases, to try to get informers, to try to find out, you know.
But some of the parts of this don't fit together. I mean, I think the caller's making a valid point, but some of those prisoners who are pictured in those horrible pictures of the abuse of prisoners were never interrogated even. Some of them, even according to all the documents that have come to light as in connection with the Taguba report and others, were never taken in for interrogation. Appear to have been, this was a form of punishment that the MPs meted out to a group of prisoners who had raped a boy in the prison yard. So it's not clear that, you know, at least in that case, that they were put up to this by military intelligence troops, because military intelligence troops weren't even dealing with these prisoners. I mean, I'm not claiming to have any answers on the culpability of military intelligence in Abu Ghraib, or at least not final answers. I think there's a lot we don't know about that yet, and a lot that needs to be investigated and learned.
Well, the memo about softening up and gitmoizing Abu Ghraib, et cetera, I mean, mm-hmm. that does give a sign that there was direction to this, and that it wasn't just some kind of... we do know that some of the perpetrators of this stuff were people who had been hired out of prison systems here, who had cases against them.
Yeah, which raises another question. I mean, it's a disturbing, perhaps even more disturbing to think that perhaps some of these methods were imported from U.S. prisons. I mean, there's some indication of that in the sworn statements of some of these MPs who were involved in the case, talking about having done this at their old jobs.
Let's go to another caller here. This would be Urbana in line number 3. Hello.
Hello. It seems to me there's a basic problem with this intelligence gathering, in that it's fairly easy for a guerrilla group, a resistance people, to negate the value of the intelligence by simply presetting stories that they can feed that are false. We've repeatedly bombed wedding parties. Now, somewhere we were getting false intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, that's always a huge issue. And I mean, there are ways that interrogators try to confirm the information they're getting. There are multiple ways. I mean, when they question a prisoner, the first thing they do is try to get a chronology of this prisoner's story, and then have that prisoner go through it backwards and forwards, starting at the beginning, starting at the middle, starting at the end. See if he slips up at any point. You match his account with what you're hearing from other prisoners. Ideally, you also are testing their information against different categories of intelligence, information you're picking up over intercepts of satellite telephone conversations or of images from predator surveillance aircraft, things like that. Obviously, in Afghanistan, as the caller points out, there were awful cases when they appeared to have been bombing the wrong location, the wrong target at the wrong time.
Well, it's happened in Iraq, too.
Yeah, and a lot of that comes back to faulty intelligence. This is far from a perfect science.
How much of this may be due to our hiring contractors?
Hiring contract interrogators?
Yes.
I don't know. I mean, in Afghanistan, they simply didn't exist. There was no such thing. There were contract linguists. An earlier caller mentioned that in Afghanistan there are other languages. They don't speak Arabic. They speak Pashto, Farsi. And there is in short supply as Arabic was, those languages are even shorter supply. So the United States Army relied extensively on contract linguists to do the translation in the booth in those cases. But there were no contract interrogators in Afghanistan, at least according to all of the people that I've interviewed. That was I think that first came about in Guantanamo Bay. I think that's where we first saw contract interrogators. Then you had obviously a number of them working at the facility in Abu Ghraib. And I mean, the Pentagon asserts that these are people who are trained and subject to the same rules as an actual active duty service member. And in fact, many of them are former active duty interrogators. But it's still, you know, it's still a disturbing.
At least one of them was a South African who was.
Yeah, it's still a disturbing practice, and it's you know, I think that the whole practice is under reconsideration.
Does it mean we really need a good professional intelligence corps?
I mean, there's no question that we need professional intelligence, and it's such short supply right now. I mean, the members of the unit that we write about in Afghanistan, many of them were in their late teens or early 20s, and these were people who were going into the booth, interrogating, in some cases, mid-level, higher-level al-Qaeda figures who just have more life experience. I mean, who forget about whether their resistant methods, their methods of resisting interrogation are effective. They just have been around longer. I mean, and that poses an obstacle. I mean, it's clear that the United States needs to continue to build up its human intelligence corps. I mean, even at the CIA right now, as we heard CIA director, or former director George Tenet, testifying on the Capitol Hill earlier this year, he thinks they're 5 years away from having the full clandestine service, that is, overseas spying service, that this country needs to fight the war on terrorism. It's a huge problem.
We have, unfortunately, maybe just 3-4 minutes left. I'm interested in thinking about some of the things you said earlier about the fact that the differences, for example, between doing an interrogation of a regular Army soldier and somebody who was in al-Qaeda,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that people in al-Qaeda, they're not wearing military uniforms, they're insignia, and you could, I'm sure, imagine being in a situation where you have a number of individuals who pretty much all look the same. They're all dressed the same. You ask them who they are, why they were in Afghanistan, where they come from, what they do. They've all got a kind of an innocuous answer that would indicate that they were picked up by mistake. They had nothing to do with al-Qaeda. They weren't combatants. And that your job as an interrogator is just even to at the get-go decide who of those people, of whom that actually is true,
right,
and then the other people that might be in possession of greater information, and then you would go from there and do what you had to do. How do you even, in the beginning, start to make that assessment to separate the people who are just citizen farmers, individuals, people who are innocent, and those people who actually are combatants?
Well, it's a painstaking process. I mean, there were a number of factors at work, and particularly in Afghanistan. When Arabs were captured and taken into custody in Afghanistan, they just simply were not released. They would end up going on to Guantanamo Bay because there were just too much of a reluctance among senior military officials in Afghanistan to let somebody go and then run the risk of somehow down the road learning you've released the 20th hijacker or something. When Afghans were taken into custody, then it was a tougher thing you're right. I mean, you could be dealing with a farmer, you could be dealing with a senior al-Qaeda sympathizer, Taliban operative, that kind of thing. Ideally, you would like to get a good deal of information on the circumstances of that person's capture. Where was this? What kind of safe house was this? What was found at that compound? How many weapons? Were there RPGs there? Were there, how many rifles and that kind of thing? And it's just from there, it's a painstaking process of requiring that prisoner to give you his sort of life story and seeing if it adds up. And there's no easy way to do that but to dive in and continue to test that his claims over and over with other information you get and to run him back and forth through that story and to see if he slips.
I know that you've also done some reporting on the 9/11 Commission,
mm-hmm.
And that they, at least as far as Iraq is concerned, they stayed away from saying too much about Iraq because essentially they said that that was not our charge.
Mm-hmm.
But they certainly have talked a lot about the way intelligence is gathered and the way American intelligence is structured. As you look at the recommendations of the commission, is there anything there that to you really stands out as being something important and also something that really everybody in Washington, D.C. is kind of getting behind and rallying around as an idea for something that really should be done to improve intelligence?
Well, you know, there, some of these recommendations have been kicked around for a number of years, and I have to admit that I'm not necessarily convinced yet that creating a new director of national intelligence, which is their principal recommendation,
mm-hmm.
is going to solve these problems. I mean, there are lots of smart people who believe it will, but there are some pretty smart people who believe it won't, and that creating a new, yet another layer, a bureaucratic layer between the president and his principal intelligence gathering and operational agency, the CIA, might be a step in the wrong direction. But I did cover this 9/11 commission for our paper, and last Friday was having a conversation with the chairman of the commission, Governor Thomas Keene, and he says that. He said that there were a couple things that really dismayed him during the hearings that they held throughout this year. One of those moments was the one I referred to a moment ago, when George Tenet said that it would take 5 years before the United States had the clandestine service it needs in the war on terror, and Keene and others believe that we just simply don't have 5 years. That you're going to have to find a way to move faster, and I think that's obvious.
Hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much for giving us your time today. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Our guest, Greg Miller, he is a national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times in the paper's Washington, D.C. Bureau, and is the co-author of the book, The Interrogators, Inside the Secret War Against Al-Qaeda, and it is published by Little Brown. Our program today, in fact, all of our programming, made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, covering, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes, Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. A reminder that we will be having continuing coverage of the Democratic Convention tonight here on AM 580. Among the featured speakers tonight is Barack Obama, candidate for Senate here from the state of Illinois. The coverage begins at 7 p.m. here tonight on AM 580. Why don't you stay tuned now, because up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. The host is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we will talk with two psychologists about memory. Mark McDaniel and Jill Einstein will join us following the 1 o'clock news. They are the authors of Memory Fitness, a guide for successful aging. Let's turn our attention now to what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. September wheat, 320 and three quarters, down 3. December, 334 and a half, down 3. September corn, 221 and three quarters, down 1.5. December, 229, check that latest tick, 230, down 1 and 3 quarters. March,